And now we turn to Melissa Wild from the University of Pennsylvania. Melissa wrote Vatican II, A Sociological Analysis of Religious Change with Princeton University Press. We're going to be talking about her book that's just about to be coming out on the influence of white supremacy and the evolution of 21st century American religion with University of California Press. Thank you for joining us, Melissa.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So what's the title of your new book?
Well, it could change, but I think as of yesterday, I have committed to Birth Control Battles, How Race and Class Divided American Religion.
That's right. And it's a great book. You were generous enough to let us take a peek at what you wrote. And it's about the culture wars. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Sure. So the question that, you know, animates the whole book is really, why and how have the politics of sex and gender come to be the fulcrum around which progressive and conservative religions in particular, but Americans in general, kind of revolve? So I wanted to kind of take that C. Wright Mills advice and take a taken for granted, which is that progressives are progressive on sex and conservatives are conservative on sex, and instead try to understand how we got to the point where we are, where that's the case.
Tell us, what's your subject? What's the subject of this book? What do you study?
Right. So in order to answer that question, I had to go, I'm a comparative historical sociologist. And so I had to go back, I had to find the first issue that really divided the American religious field on an issue of sex and gender. And I wasn't sure, but I had a hunch that it was going to be birth control. I also checked out women's suffrage, and I found out that it really, suffrage did not divide the field the way that birth control did, that some religious groups made statements about it, but most of them didn't. And when religious groups made statements about suffrage, it wasn't contentious, and it wasn't like the other religious groups were responding to those statements. It was just one of those more banal issues at the time. In contrast, 10 years later, circa 1929, 1930, all of a sudden, 9 of America's most prominent religious groups really suddenly liberalized on the issue of contraception and put forward official statements saying that contraception needed to be made legal, so that, and in those statements, the reason why they were fighting for contraception to be made legal was really clear. And it was basically so that there would be fewer but better children in the United States. And that kind of became the animus of my whole project. And I traced that the effect of, so the first part of the book explains why some groups liberalized and others did not. And then the second half of the book traces the effects of that liberalization and their views on contraception up until the invention of the pill in 1965.
So this early wave was kind of emergent of like the general social gospel, progressivism, eugenics fad.
Right.
Of like the late Victorian era, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And how well did this map onto the kind of general modernist fundamentalist split at the time?
You know, that's a great question. And I would say not very well. One of the alternative hypotheses I really had to counter early in the research was that progressives liberalized on birth control and conservatives didn't. And the way that I ended up operationalizing that, because there are a lot of religious histories that make claims about modernism and fundamentalism and how that differentiated the American religious field. But there have been very few attempts to actually systematically categorize religious groups according to their identities and their views on various topics over the course of the American, of the last century, for example. So what I ended up finding was that there were plenty of groups that saw themselves as religious progressives that did not liberalize on birth control. They identified as believers in the social gospel movement, for example, and that tended to be correlated with the modernism fundamentalism debate, but it wasn't perfectly correlated at all.
And so what were the drivers that were shaping people's views on birth control?
Really, it came down to two factors. One was whether groups were concerned about race suicide or not, and whether they believed in the social gospel. So let me tackle the race suicide angle first. Okay. So the race suicide concerns came out of the eugenics movement. But it's really important that I emphasize that not all eugenicists were concerned about race suicide in the early 20th century. So in particular, there were plenty of eugenicists in the South who were not concerned about race suicide. Race suicide basically was a term that was popularized by Roosevelt when he was president, which was the suicide part was intentionally trying to encourage white Anglo-Saxon Protestants to have more babies, basically saying that you are engaging in race suicide if you are choosing to have only two kids while these Catholic and Jewish immigrants are having four on average, right? And so it was what we call positive genetics, an attempt to encourage desirable parents to have more kids, is where the term race suicide comes from. But so groups in the South who were eugenicists but weren't concerned about race suicide, they were not motivated to liberalize on birth control. And I have some great data from, for example, the Southern Baptist Convention saying things in their periodicals like, just last week we had 19 babies in the hospital. The Southern Baptist Convention doesn't believe in race suicide. Which, of course, those babies were obviously white, although they don't say it.
Right, of course.
But the groups that liberalized were really concerned about race suicide. However, not all of the groups concerned about race suicide officially liberalized on birth control. In order to officially liberalize on birth control in the early period, they also had to believe in the social gospel movement, which meant that they had to believe that making statements about social good, they had to believe that changing society was their religious duty. So the way I explain the social gospel movement is that basically you have two types of religious groups. One group is waiting for Jesus to come back and fix everything. And the other group says, listen, Jesus is not coming back until we fix the mess we've made ourselves. And social gospelers really fell into that latter camp. They really believed that they needed to fix society. So they were focused on eradicating poverty, avoiding war, a host of other social goods that they...
It was like it was like activist religion, basically.
Yes. So if you think of settlement houses and that, a lot of that came from the social gospel movement.
It really, because I've always heard this, but I've never been sure about it. Because like now, especially liberals will talk about like premillennial dispensationalist theology. And then you talk to a lot of like evangelicals themselves and they're like, I don't know. I don't really think about that. But you're saying that eschatological concerns were tightly correlated with social gospel kind of attitudes.
Yeah. I mean, I think it was both doctrinal, but also cultural. Mm-hmm. Basically, you know, these religious groups just believed that it was their religious duty to reform society. And then other groups believed that it was their duty to focus on personal salvation. So that was really the divide. And that's where, that's a divide where, you know, that relates to the modernism fundamentalism divide, but there were fundamentalist groups who believed in the social gospel movement.
Yeah. So I got a couple more questions. So with this, the race suicide attitude, was the idea that if we liberalize birth control, it means that they will have fewer children than us? Or was the idea that if we keep restrictions on birth control, that we will have more kids? And then the other was how much of this was genetic and how much of it was kind of Lamarckian? Because I know that during this period, even people who thought of themselves as eugenicists would say things that are kind of crazy from a genetic perspective, like if the father's drunk at the moment of conception, the kids will be imbeciles or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Those are three great questions. Let me tackle. So the first one was, how much of this was about genetics? For eugenicists, genetics, religion, spirituality, intelligence, it was all, they believed all of those things came together, yes, at the moment of conception. And so, yeah, right. It's not just whether, you know, the guy was drunk at the time of conception. It's also about whether he drank in excess ever, right? So it was about kind of creating the perfect, what did they call it? Germline
or something,
right?
Like that.
Yeah. So they really believe that genetics were malleable, but really only for white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. Okay. So for everybody else, there was just a problematic genetic history that could be connected to all kinds of, you know, unseemly behaviors and They very much believed, for example, that education was in some ways inherited, right? So there was like a class reproduction aspect of it as well. It wasn't just race.
And not just in the sense of the latent capacity to be educated as heritable, but in the sense like in the counterfactual where I get more education as compared to the counterfactual where I don't, but I still have the same genes.
My kids will be smarter. Yeah. Like they didn't differentiate between necessarily like their kids being smarter and being more educated. Like there was no attempt to do that, right?
It was the idea that if we liberalize birth control, that means they will have fewer kids, or is the idea that if we keep birth control tight, we will have more kids?
Basically, you're asking about the difference between positive and negative eugenics. So for the longest time, the people who were really concerned about race suicide were pushing positive genetics. They were trying to convince desirable parents to have more kids. And I have this really awesome postcard that I use in when I give a talk on the book, which was given to a bride upon her wedding. And it's Teddy Roosevelt, and he's toasting her. May all of your problems be little ones. Right? He's encouraging her to. But then the person who gave the postcard to the bride added in handwriting, but not too many. Right. Okay. So because they were fighting this cultural sense among upper class white Anglo-Saxon Protestants at the time that it just wasn't seemly to have more than two kids, that you needed to concentrate on rearing your kids. Right. So they were fighting this. And then so for a long time, they did want to restrict. They wanted to keep birth control illegal because they didn't want to make the matter worse. But then, the whole field of demography and as sociology as well was to some extent formed out of these concerns at this time. Was many aspects of our disciplines come back to this. They had developed good statistics. And so they were able to see that the birth rate differential was not going away and that they weren't being successful at convincing the people they wanted to have more kids to have more kids. And so that's when they switched to the negative eugenics campaign. And of course, there was overlap between them. So, but some of the negative eugenics was involuntary sterilization laws and where they, where they were able to put those in place in certain states. But then as they were working on the involuntary sterilization laws or eugenical sterilization, as they called it, they also started considering, as a result of Margaret Sanger's activism with the American Birth Control League, that the best way to decrease the birth rate differential, because that's what they were really concerned about, was the differential. And this was connected to politics. This was connected to Northeast urban geography. They realized that basically upper class women had more access to physicians, and it was because it was illegal. They were the ones that got access to birth control, and they were trying to both. So they basically had realized that by increasing access to birth control, they would get rid of this birth rate differential. And, they were right.
Yeah.
Because, by talking to some of my demographer colleagues, for example, natural fertility for a married woman at this time was about 8. So these women were, moderating their fertility somehow, but they didn't have the best means to do so. Right. And so they were right that by increasing access to birth control, they would most likely reduce their family sizes. And within, 30 years, there's almost no difference.
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned the role of like early social science in this, because, if you go way back, you find that American economics and American sociology both came out of kind of Christian socialist progressive eugenics, basic group of people.
Well, I was totally stunned to find that the president of the American Eugenics Society from 1929 to 1931, the American Eugenics Society basically just folded and then kind of became the Population Association of America. And so he was the first president of the Population Association of America from 1932 to 1936. And then
why don't they put this in all the public sociology material, right? I mean, this is like
it gets better. And then he was the 1936 president of the American Sociological Association.
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah. Like, none of us are off the hook. And that's a great slide. I don't emphasize this in my book, because it's not really relevant to the research question that much. But I do have a footnote where I get to, talk about it a lot.
That's why it's like murky, then Talcott Parsons, right? First, there was something we won't detain ourselves.
We don't really need to talk about anymore. Yeah, I mean, you know, Francis Galton's one of his most famous. He was kind of the founder of eugenics. One of his most famous articles was published in the American Journal of Sociology.
Oh, that's nice.
In 1905, and then you know they published my Fewer and Better Children article. It was the first part of the book. I almost wanted to say like, hey.
All right, so we're now at like what, 1920? So what happens next?
Oh, so no, we're at about 1930, where these religious groups suddenly, nine of them suddenly liberalized, and I explain why they did, and the other groups either only unofficially supported reform. Those would be the folks who were concerned about race suicide but did not believe in the social gospel movement, so they didn't see it as a religious duty. Or they openly criticized reform, and those would be the groups who were not concerned about race suicide and didn't believe in the social gospel movement. So in that cell, you have all kinds of strange bedfellows, like the Southern Baptist Convention and the Roman Catholic Church.
Okay, so that's weird to me, because I always heard that the Southern Baptist Convention was pro-choice until Francis Schaeffer talked them into being pro-life after Roe v. Wade, and that the basic logic was kind of an own the libs thing, except it was own the papists. So,
so you're totally shifting the dependent variable on me right now, because I'm studying contraception and not abortion, just to be clear.
So they were in favor of contraception but against abortion.
The Southern Baptist Convention was critical of birth control reform.
Oh, they were for contraception, contraception.
I have to get to the 1950s.
Yeah, you say it because I'm lying.
So they were early critics, and then there was also a segment of the American religious field that was silent and remained silent for a long time. And so then, basically 1935 starts the second half of the book. And what I did was I took all of these religious groups. I had 30 religious groups in my sample, which I didn't probably explain to you earlier. And I traced them over the course of the next 30 years and just traced their views on contraception. And what I found was that what had initially been four groups of religious groups turned into two, where you have the religious promoters of contraception, and they basically, what was really surprising to me was all the way through 1965, they really don't change their tune. The fertility of who they're concerned about changes. So rather than being focused on the whitening Italian and Jewish immigrants in the United States and their kids, they shift their population. They shift their focus to the third world and then blacks in the inner cities. Right. So that's but it was never a conversation about rights, like the way that I expected it to be, like the way that the conversation happens today. Right. It was really still focused on responsible parenthood, increasing responsibility, which basically, you know, is a way of saying that there are some irresponsible people, right? If you're focused on making everybody responsible. That's only half of the religious field. The other half I call the reluctant endorsers, pretty much with the exception of two holdouts, one of which is the Catholic Church, which we talked about enough today.
It's Catholic Day.
With the exception of two holdouts, the rest of the religious field did liberalize on contraception eventually. They're all okay with it. It's just that they liberalized in a really different way. And rather than
what period is this?
Starting in the 50s, and then, you know, the really late liberalizers, some of them liberalized in the 90s officially. Mm-hmm. But I have statements of them saying things like, listen, we're a Bible society. We're not doctors. We're not here to tell you which means of contraception is good or bad. As far as we can tell, it's fine for married people to use it, right? Yeah. So they concentrate on when is it okay for their believers to use it, you know, in what circumstances. And so I call them the reluctant endorsers. So they basically say, yeah, go ahead and use it, but they're not concentrating on controlling anyone else's fertility, like the religious promoters continue to do.
Sure. So I mean, I know you said you don't want to talk about the Catholic Church anymore, but like this is the same period when Humani Vitae passed. Mm-hmm. And like I know that one of the reasons that Humani Vitae hit people so hard is that there was serious, like, wasn't there like a report that basically said the church should liberalize? And then the Pope went with the Minority Report. And so it was kind of like a frustrated expectations kind of deal. But it was in that exact period. Like, Humani Vitae is like mid-60s or something, right?
67, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so one of the case studies in Vatican II is on birth control and what happened to it at the council. And it's one of the most useful case studies because it allows me to differentiate lay pressure from the pressure that came from other religious organizations, right? Because birth control was really the issue that there was lay pressure on at the time. And yes, you're right. There was a report that the Pope removed it from the agenda. He appointed a special commission. The special commission report was leaked. They said we should allow contraception. And then the Pope just chickened out basically and said, like, no, I'm not going to do this. Which is an example of kind of, which is kind of where that conversation piece that we were talking about earlier came from, in the sense that his statement ended up having lacking authority, right, in terms of people adhering to it, in terms of people being upset about it, because it was coming out after this council where everybody got together and kind of via consensus decided what made sense. But one of the arguments is that progressives basically left birth control off the agenda. They let it happen, whereas they refused to let that happen with other issues that they were prioritizing for other reasons. But that gets back into the council, so I don't know if we want to do that. But. But yes, it's all about the same period of time. And you know, before Roe v. Wade.
So at what point did it become a rights discourse, and how much was that tied up with the churches? Because, I mean, now, if you look at, like, mainline churches and Reformed Judaism, kind of the solid religious left, they adopt that same rights discourse. They don't just treat it as like, well, it's we're not going to tell you what to do.
You know, I'm actually, I'm not sure, and that may be the topic of my next book, but I was surprised. So I ended the analysis in Birth Control Battles goes from 1918 to 1965. Mm-hmm. And I decided I had to stop the book there because otherwise I was never going to get promoted.
not until after your Nobel.
But, right. <Yeah. laughs> Hadn't even Nobel Prize. But I do think I expected to see the rights discourse by 1965, and I was really surprised that I didn't see it. I suspect it comes about after Roe v. Wade. Once the discourse comes around a right to privacy, that must be when the rights discourse really takes off. But I don't know, and I would have to do a comparable amount of research on my religious organizations.
Sure. So I understand this is speculative because you haven't done the actual research yet, but you know that would seem to imply. You know, so there's this whole idea of like how much are ideas bottom up and how much are they top down, or, you know, which is kind of a variation on like the great man of history. And that would imply that the specific legal reasoning that the court used to decide on Roe v. Wade was, and, you know, Griswold, was somewhat decisive in shaping how we think about it. And in the same way that I think there's much stronger evidence that the way the court decided Bakke shaped the way that we talk about affirmative action, right? Nobody talked about diversity before Bakke. And the court basically invented the word diversity. I mean, it's based on like a Princeton Alumni Weekly article, but basically they pulled out of thin air. Previous to that, people thought about it as just a way to remediate social inequality between ethnic groups or to make up for past discrimination. And I forget which justice, but one of them basically just pulled up this word diversity. And that's like a huge part of our discourse now, right? At the University of California, we're evaluated along with teaching, service, and research on diversity, you know, and that's something that came basically out of the arbitrary decision of one Supreme Court justice. And it sounds like you're saying that kind of privacy and rights was a similar issue with sexuality.
I think so. That would be a hypothesis to test another day. But yeah.
I appreciate you're saying that as speculative. Yeah. Okay. So I have one more question for you, which is precisely because you – so when I asked about fundamentalist modernists, you said like, well, it's really hard to code and that sort of thing. But, you know, I mean, you managed to, I mean, you live in 2018 with the rest of us, and you started your study around World War I, you know, which is kind of the height of modernism. Mm-hmm. That's when we started getting source criticism and, you know, the Scopes monkey trial and all that business. So how well, if, let's say that you were to naively take the RELTRAD code, right, the religious traditions code, and you were to just apply it and just say, if you were if you were a conservative Protestant in, you know, 2002 or whenever Bob Wuthnow's students wrote that paper, or you were, you know, liberal Protestant in that period, then you were the same thing in 1920. How well would that work? Or to ask another question, were there any denominations that crossed over from having been modernist to becoming evangelicals or vice versa?
Yeah. So that was one of the questions that I animated the project actually from the beginning. And I have to tell you, so what I was able to do, I took all of my groups and I did code them for their official stances on abortion and when they changed over time, as well as same-sex marriage. And this is complete speculation. And this is a claim that I can't really prove until I fill in the data points, right? But what I can tell you is that the correlation is astounding, that of the 9 early liberalizers, they have, because of mergers, they are today, they represent 7 different denominations, 5 of whom marry same-sex couples, all of whom are pro-choice, but 5 of whom marry same-sex couples, and they are the only 5 American religious denominations that marry same-sex couples. So the overall.
And I'm going to guess those are also the ones that ordained women.
Well, actually, Mark Shaves has a pretty interesting study of.
Oh, that's right, because fundamentalists do that.
Yeah,
too.
They do. And that goes. They do. But they did it for really different reasons, and it wasn't seen as.
Yeah.
There are basically 2 waves. The second wave of people do so for symbolic reasons to show solidarity with the feminist movement. But the first wave of folks that do it for really different reasons.
What, like something about universal priesthood of believers, that sort of thing?
Yeah. So. So what I was surprised by, so this is kind of a good segue into kind of where my work has gone now. I was really just stunned by the continuity, that there wasn't a lot of change, that actually the sides have remained remarkably consistent over time in terms of who was liberal, if you could say liberal, who was in favor of legalizing birth control and who wasn't, and kind of how that translated over the course of the next century in terms of groups' orientation towards sex and sexuality and gender. And I really think so, and I have evidence in the book that that having made an early pronouncement on birth control basically moved groups toward seeing themselves as leaders on the issue of sex and on the issue of gender. So I have a great quote from a Methodist periodical where they say, "We were the first ones to say that contraception is a moral duty." And of course they weren't. They were among the first. But the fact is that they have an identity, of being among the first. And that, and it seems like that identity is ended up being really important over the course.
Yeah, and that cultural memory, even if it's fallacious, is more important than what actually happened.
Right, and actually, it's also about what's written down. That's the really amazing thing about studying religious groups and doing so comparative historically is that, they document themselves and then people go and look it up, right? To see like, what did we say again? So they do have a pressure to be consistent, right? And so they do look things up.